I'm Eilif Tronsen, the project leader of the Nordic EdTech Network project funded by Nordic Innovation. I'm at my office at SRI in Silicon Valley with Michael Staten.
Hello.
A partner in one of the most active EdTech investors here in the Valley, and I guess in the world. Mm-hmm. Michael has been to the Nordic Innovation House in Palo Alto a number of times, so he's familiar with the Nordics in the Valley. And one of my personal goals is to get Michael to the Nordics in the next year and make him an honorary Viking.
All right.
And he's just told me he'll be in Helsinki, hopefully.
Yeah.
So, soon, at Slush. In the next 30 minutes or so, we'll talk a bit first about Michael himself and Learn Capital, so you can all understand where he's coming from and where Learn Capital fits into the EdTech venture landscape here in the Valley. Mm-hmm. Then we'll talk a bit about some EdTech issues and developments, especially relating to raising capital by EdTech startups and what some of these things might mean for the growing number of Nordic EdTech startups. So let me start by welcoming you, Michael, to this podcast series. We are really pleased and honored that you could take the time out of your day and to come here and share some of your perspectives on this emergent EdTech industry. So, first, can you start by talking for a few minutes about yourself and your background? And I must note that I like what you wrote in your LinkedIn profile, namely that you are a serial schemer, conspirator, co-founder, and now investor.
Yes. Yeah.
So, and that's a great summary, but I'm sure you had some good things to add about yourself, your background, and
sure.
Learn Capital.
Sure. So I did my studies in undergraduate and graduate school in economic development, in my late teens and early 20s.
How many economists do?
Yeah. And I just kept on coming back to the idea that education and entrepreneurship were kind of the two biggest drivers of kind of wealth and shared prosperity. And obviously lots of other institutions and kind of cultural practices and activities need to come into place. But essentially, I looked at those two as really the biggest drivers from my perspective. And I applied to a bunch of jobs I wasn't qualified for, doing business development, ecosystem development, a lot like the Nordic EdTech Network and the Nordic Innovation and Techis and a number of, but doing it in emerging markets, so Africa, Latin America. And I got the feedback that I had never been an entrepreneur and I had never grown a business, so therefore was underqualified. And so I got a job as a teacher. I was like, well, if I'm not going to get a job incubating entrepreneurs, I'll incubate minds, right? And so I started as a public school teacher in Houston, Texas, which is where I'm from. And the goal wasn't necessarily to become an entrepreneur in education or merge those two ideas as much as I got into the school systems and was just immediately struck with how many challenges could be met with better technology innovation through entrepreneurial thinking and entrepreneurial activities.
Right.
And kind of immediately and without even really thinking about it, was suddenly trying to start an after-school program and trying to start a summer academy. And I maxed out a credit card and didn't know how to price anything. And other than making a cute website, kind of failed dramatically. And then I still ran my after-school program and was in the classroom, and I started thinking about all these technology tools that I would like to see as a teacher for me and my students.
Right.
And so started to learn to code and was trying to do different things. And, I had a class portfolio website that was a WordPress mod and all this stuff. And I got a call from one of my friends that had just joined a little startup in 2005 called Facebook. And he tells me, hey, you seem very entrepreneurial. If you want to be an entrepreneur, you should come out to Palo Alto. And I didn't know where Palo Alto was, and Stanford was a school I would never get into, and that's pretty much the only thing I thought about it. And a few weeks later, I got a phone call from somebody saying, hey, I got your name from this guy who worked at Facebook, and I'm starting a company out here in Palo Alto. I have a little bit of funding, and he said, you might be my guy, right? And so he told me what he was doing, and I told him why I could be his guy, and the next thing I knew, I had a plane ticket and a salary and moved out to Palo Alto. And so I spent 3 years living in Palo Alto.
Is that university or?
No. So that was a startup that spent too much money too fast. Oh, so I learned one way to die is to spend too much. Actually, the only way to die is to spend too much money too fast. But I joined that startup. That was spending too much money too fast and was headed towards, you know, a brick wall, basically. Really talented team, though. People from that company have gone on to start a number of really different important companies. The most important one is probably Airbnb.
Oh.
So I worked with one of the founders of Airbnb there. But met a lot of great people and saw one way not to do it. And then started my own company. Got some traction through the Facebook platform because I was in there in Palo Alto and knew how to do that, and got a lot of users, and then so venture capital threw money at me, and Founders Fund invested in me and the company, and that became Uversity.
Okay.
And through a series of pivots, Uversity became something that I'm less excited about now, but it became kind of an enrollment management site for higher education.
Okay.
That works a lot like a Facebook group, basically. Right. It's like Facebook groups for enrolling in college.
Okay.
Kind of the easiest way to explain it. And then that was sold 2 years ago. But I had brought in a CEO at the request of the board because it got kind of big for me to handle. And immediately saw that I had learned a whole lot and I wanted to go on to yet another entrepreneurial idea. And I was helping a guy. I fell in entrepreneurial love with a potential co-founder. He was going to be founder CEO. We were working on a couple of ideas together, and then he calls me up and says, hey, I think I got something. And I say, what is it? And he said, well, one of my friends really wants to learn how to code. I told him it would be easy. He could do the whole thing in 10 weeks, and I would teach it to him. And so last night I put up on a website, I'm going to do a developer boot camp called Dev Boot Camp, and it's going to be 10 weeks, and it's 10 grand. Does anybody else want to come? And last night, before I went to bed, I got 300 applications that want to pay me $10,000. I think this is probably a good idea. And I said, very cool. And I ended up getting an entrepreneur in residence gig at Learn Capital. I worked with the CEO of Dev Bootcamp to come up with a growth strategy that Learn Capital could back. And then ultimately we disagreed on that growth strategy. And so I was kind of an honorary co-founder / co-conspirator of Dev Bootcamp. On the side somewhere in there, I helped to start another company called UnCollege. And then I accidentally started something called Higher Ed Live, which is a whole nother story. But anyway, so kind of four different ventures later, and then somewhere in there, I also helped New Schools Venture Fund spin out a seed fund, which is now Reach Capital. So
right.
Jennifer Carolyn and Wei Yi, I worked there part time. I just kind of helped them look at investment opportunities. So. Somehow in the past decade, I've been involved with, five different startups,
yeah.
Two different ed tech funds. So sorry
perfect
to be long
background
winded,
for moving into, the Learn Capital
the growing trend is to have venture capital funds that are managed by former founders and operators.
Yeah, who have been there.
In
the trenches.
Yeah, it's kind of like there are some nuanced understandings of being in the trenches of being a founder that, first of all, helps you select really
right.
great founders, and then
yeah.
number two, a good portion of our role is actually just being a therapist.
Right.
And so having been a founder, you make a more credible founder therapist, right? And that's...
You know, I recently read a very interesting report, I thought. You know, EdSearch puts out a lot of good stuff,
sure.
And as you know. And this report was called State of EdTech.
Yes.
And the actual report was, there were two parts, and the second part was how money shapes tools in schools.
Yes.
And the report had a table with the top 10 investors in EdTech, and five of those had 100% of their portfolio in EdTech.
Yeah.
And Learn Capital was one of those five, of course.
Yeah.
And it showed...
schools is the other one, Reach.
Yeah.
Reach Capital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it showed that you were the second largest in terms of the number of deals. And
yes.
This was over a five-year time period. So can you say a little more about Learn Capital, including what your portfolio looks like, and then a bit about what kinds of investments you're now looking for, and what kinds of ed tech companies you're seeing out there that you find kind of exciting?
Mm-hmm. Sure. In the beginning, a number of investments that we made were what we would call kind of teacher productivity tools, things that teachers generally in K-12 education adopt to make their life easier, to help them improve what they're doing.
Right.
So Edmodo, ClassDojo, Mastery Connect, LearnZillion, and others.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that probably somewhere around 12 of our companies are these teacher-adopted technology platforms. We do also have kind of learner-adopted technology platforms also in the K-12 space. So Brainly is a good example of that.
Okay.
We also have what we call cloud-powered schools. So we think that there's a lot of innovation and imagination happening in how to redesign school. A number of them are charter schools. Charter schools in the U.S. are these kind of hybrid organizations where they tend to be nonprofit, independent organizations that are funded by state governments to create new options for families.
Right.
And so a number of them are charter schools, but a number of them are also private schools or some variation on private school. And so we have a number of those companies in our portfolio. So Bridge International Academies is working in Kenya and now in Liberia, Nigeria, and in India.
Okay.
And Alt School is here in San Francisco and
right.
New York and
now
in Chicago.
They attract a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
So we also have a cloud-powered university, which is called Minerva. And we have a few variations on that, like Andela, which is a software applied software engineering academy based in Lagos, Nigeria, Nairobi, Kenya, and they're opening in South Africa now. We also have Make School, which is very similar. It's a tuition-free two-year applied software engineering program where you pay back out of your salary.
Mm-hmm.
They also operate summer camps for kids in high school.
Right.
That teach them how to code and build applications and games. And so they're here in San Francisco, but they have camps now in six different countries in the world. So all combined, the portfolio is reaching about 300 million unique registered learners. I shouldn't say unique registered learners. It could be duplicate. But, the portfolio now has a pretty broad reach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The Nordics are, you know, have always been fairly active in game-based stuff and,
yes.
and mobile. So
yes.
Do you have a number of, have you done much in that area as well?
Yes. That's been troublesome, primarily. The most successful one that we invested in was actually a success from the Nordics. He was one of the founders of King.com, which I think is a big hit in Sweden, yeah? It was a big international hit, right? And he left to do an ed tech game company for math learning called Manga High.
Okay.
So they've been somewhat successful, but at some point we got so jaded on games trying to get kids to learn, which are generally poorly designed or are not that fun to play. And we invested in another company called Brownie Points, which is actually, you have to do math in order to be able to play games.
Right.
So it basically locks your iPad. Your parents will lock your iPad, and if you want to play games, you have to earn 30 minutes by doing your math. right? So we said, well, forget, let's just use the motivation to play games and make them do it before they go and play the games they actually want to play. So we're definitely of mixed mind on the role of games and learning.
Yeah, it's far from trivial. It's really hard to combine the two.
It is. It's hard. It's hard to get it right.
Yeah. Now, go on to the next one here. The last 5 years or so has seen, you know, obviously a significant increase in edtech investment, especially here in the U.S., but perhaps also worldwide. From where you sit, what have been some of the most interesting developments in the last 2-3 years, and what are some of the challenges that the edtech industry as a whole now faces, and what do you think that means for early stage in entrepreneurs? And as you know, in the Valley, there's talk now about things turning down a bit, and are we going to see that in edtech as well? So how do you see that evolving, Michael?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it has been a good time to be an edtech entrepreneur. There's more funding available. There are more funders. Generalist venture capital generally has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 companies that they've backed in edtech. For them, it's still kind of an experiment. For those of us that are in it full time with all of our hearts and all of our minds, you know, it's not something that we play with. It's something we do all the time. So the good news is it's never been easier to reach learners, to reach families. It's never been easier to get adoption, to get attention. It's never been easier to try something new and be embraced by the media and get attention. But there now is something around somewhere between 1,500 and 2,500 edtech startups. So now differentiation is somewhat hard. And if you talk to people that adopt technology at the school level, or if you talk to teachers or professors, frankly, they're a bit bewildered. They're like, there's so much going on. Every time I answer my phone or look at my email, it's somebody wanting me to try some newfangled thing. And so now differentiation is key.
Right.
And a lot of the ideas that may have been obvious, you know, a decade ago have been tried, and there are a number of companies that are doing them now.
Right.
And so, you know, we're kind of moving to a world where I think there are a few things. First is finding those new ideas might be a little harder. And differentiating yourself in a competitive market might be a little harder. And so moving from early stage adoption to mass market adoption is proving to be challenging for a number of companies that get off the ground successfully but then need to go somewhere.
And then finding a way to make some revenue.
Yeah, that doesn't feel like as much of a challenge as some people make it out to be. I think that people that don't spend a lot of time looking at these companies assume that none of them are making revenue, and that's not true at all.
Right.
We're actually seeing companies that are getting revenue earlier, that are more capital efficient, that find ways to unlock value. Sometimes it's straightforward, sometimes it's creative, in ways that maybe we didn't see 5 years ago, right? So now we'll see a company that's 1 or 2 years old that has already made $1 million, $2 million in revenue. And that's relatively common. You also have a much more active kind of, quote, consumer market, meaning that people are much more willing to kind of get out their credit cards and pay $10 a month, $20 a month, $30 a month. They're willing to enroll in programs that where most of the experience, if not all of the experience, is online. In addition, we see a lot of, particularly parents, really want better options for their kids. And they're not just active, they're like aggressive early adopters of things that might be great. But it does mean you're put through a high pass filter, because if you don't meet their expectations, you're out. But yeah, we're definitely seeing parents driving decisions. We're also seeing, you know, companies where entrepreneurs before might have been like, oh, well, we're going to create a new type of learning management system or content delivery system. Say, you know what? I'm just going to make a whole new school from scratch, right? Because, like, why am I going to fight tooth and nail to build a really meaningful company that doesn't change the system when the whole system needs to be changed? And so there are a lot of systems change thinkers that are choosing to start their own schools and school networks now.
Yeah.
And I think 5 years ago, people would have thought that that's almost impossible.
Right.
And now there's this kind of black swan effect where just the fact that these things exist change what people think are possible. And so now we see business plans all the time that are like, I'm going to create a whole new school. And some want to create a whole new school here in the U.S. Some want to do it in Europe. Some want to do it in emerging markets. So
let's move a little away from the Valley and internationally. Yeah. I have a few questions on that. So I think I read, and we talked a little bit earlier about you have a number of international investors, and including I think I saw that Pearson was one of your first investors. But how closely do you monitor and look for interesting edtech investments internationally? And of course, we in the Nordic region are wondering, if you'll be coming to the Nordic looking actively at some of the things happening there. Is that likely to happen?
We're a small team, and because we're called Learn Capital, we're pretty easy to find. So we don't really have much time to go hunting.
Right.
So I have been to the Nordic region twice, have met with startups in the Nordic region twice, in Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Finland.
Right.
And so I would say of companies that we look at in general, somewhere between 30% and 40% of them are not based here in the U.S. Probably something like a third of the international companies that come across our desk are from the Nordic region or have Nordic entrepreneurs. So from our perspective, given the population of Sweden and Norway and Denmark and Finland,
we're doing pretty well.
You're doing pretty well, actually. You definitely are rising above the fold. We probably see more entrepreneurs per capita from those countries than anywhere else.
And we drive more Teslas per capita than anywhere in the world.
That's good. So we are interested in companies from the Nordic region for two primary reasons. So the first is that what we call the trade craft of entrepreneurship, right? And the trade craft of building great technology, is just more present in the Nordics than almost anywhere else besides Silicon Valley, right? Building a company requires great talent, and requires a lot of people that are familiar with this trade craft. It also requires an ecosystem of advisors and mentors and coffee conversations and meetups and all this stuff that I think the Nordic region has actually been, even though, you know, just before we got on this podcast here, you had talked about there was a need for that.
Right.
I actually see you guys doing it better than... I mean, even the fact that you would acknowledge there's a need for it is like...
I think it's happening in individual countries.
Yeah.
Now we try to do it regional for the whole
region. Yeah. So anyway, this trade craft and the ecosystem are there in the Nordic region. And then the other reason we see is that because the Nordic countries are a relatively small markets, companies very quickly realize they need to succeed internationally, and they have the courage to do so. And so, you know, we think about the born global startup, and if you have a startup in Norway or Denmark or Sweden or Finland, you kind of know you have to be born global.
Right.
Whereas in the U.S., you can kind of pretend you don't.
So my next follow-up question to that was, then given all of that, you know, what is some of the advice you could give to these edtech companies that are thinking about that? And what have you observed in terms of, you know, things that companies have done wrong and not being prepared for this is a very competitive market.
Sure.
And you got to, you know, you got to have done your homework.
Yeah.
And but what are some of the things you've seen, and maybe even some things that companies have failed at because they've not been ready?
One of the things that I see with Nordic companies is that in some way, because they're small markets, things that have been launched in the U.S. or elsewhere have not gotten to the Nordic region yet, or haven't paid much attention to the Nordic region.
Right.
And so you get companies that feel like they're working on something new,
right,
in the Nordic region, but then once they pop their head out and try to go to the U.K. or France or the U.S., they're like, wait a minute, right? Like, this is a really competitive market. Like, there's lots of solutions, and ours isn't innovative enough, or it's not differentiated enough, or our pricing strategies don't hold as we move to international markets. Another thing that we see with Nordic companies is, I actually think kind of like government involvement in tech ecosystems is extremely important.
Right.
But particularly I think Finland is probably the most guilty of this, where companies are able to get seed money or starting
grant,
money.
Get a lot of grants and live on grants.
And they kind of live off grants for a while, and they don't get the capital efficiency and the hustle.
Right.
They kind of like skip over that part of entrepreneurship, right?
Right.
And so, you know, I've seen companies that have been kind of hanging around trying to do their thing for 3-4 years and haven't hit significant traction points.
Right.
And, you know, the company that we just invested in, you know, 2-3 months ago is a company that's less than a year and a half old and has 25 million downloads, 5 million monthly active users, you know, 3.5 million math problems solved per day,
right,
in every country on the planet, right?
Wow.
And it's like, so we're Learn Capital, and because of that, you know, we have the privilege of getting to see so many different ed tech entrepreneurs. And I think that in the Nordic region, sometimes we'll talk to companies that don't realize the level of hustle and growth that other people are able to achieve with even more limited resources.
Right.
And so, and from our perspective, we want to back that company that, you know, got 25 million users in less than a year and a half, right?
Right.
But you do have examples of companies that have done that. So Kahoot is a good example.
Right.
Right. Where when I met them, they were literally just launching. And then like a year later, they were enormous. And, right, you know, we, for whatever reason, have kind of passed on opportunities to invest on them, even though I probably would have liked us to invest in them. They've just consistently grown like mad. And so they're probably the fastest growing ed tech company in terms of user reach that we've ever seen.
Right. Wow.
You know? So there's a counterexample to that, right?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Good. Well, I think we kind of used up our time. Do you want to say a few words about what we talked about a little earlier about Learn Capital in maybe,
sure,
you know, finding some partners over in the Nordics?
Sure.
And
sure. So a business plan for Learn Capital that we don't have put together, and we're not necessarily knocking on doors or promoting it, but we do kind of float the idea sometimes, is that, you know, we'd really love to be doing investments around the world and have team members around the world that are looking at different regions, looking at different markets, and are able to play the kind of intermediary and coordinator for early stage capital into education and learning.
Right.
You need two things that the Nordic region has, but you need them to come together in a way that they have not in the Nordic region. So the first is you need sources of capital. So you need high net worth individuals, you need pension funds, you need wealth managers and asset managers, people that invest in funds.
Right.
And you need a set of entrepreneurs that are trying out new awesome things. And then that needs to come together in essentially like an early stage fund that is supporting companies in the region. And, you know, we would love to have a Nordic ed tech fund that's an affiliate of Learn Capital, but you need, you know, roughly at least $20 million U.S. dollars in capital, and you need that to fund somewhere between 4 and 8 companies. And you need at least kind of one person on the ground headquartered somewhere in the Nordic region.
Right.
And we have a number of people that we've talked to that we thought would be a good fit for that person on the ground. We just haven't had anybody step up and say, here's $20 million, go for it. Right. But ideally, we would invest that into companies in the Nordic region that are taking solutions and expanding them internationally.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's see if we can make that happen,
yeah.
Michael. And unfortunately, you won't be in Kristiansand, but we'll start the discussions there. A number of the right players will be there,
uh-huh.
who are, I think, important catalysts for each of the Nordic markets. So
mm-hmm.
I think we all want to see this happening, and we're really excited about what you have done and the role you can play in the region. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you.